for Madam Chair.
We're going to get started. We have a shorter meeting today, and we want to get started so we can give our witnesses enough time to talk with us. Okay, we'll start. Okay. I guess our fiscal staff is going to take us through the budget, but she's not here. So we'll begin with some public testimony. And we hope to be able to cover everybody who's on the list today, and there may be time for more depending on how long the testifies and how many good questions we all have. So the first person that we have down for public testimony, this testimony on the governor's budget, is Julie Ring. So Julie, come on forward. Welcome to the committee. You just want to introduce yourself and...
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. I got this appropriately aimed here. My name is Julie Ring, and I'm the director of the Local Public Health Association of Minnesota. We're the organization that represents all of the city and county health departments that work in your communities. And we are an affiliate of the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I'm here today to talk to you about the governor's budget on behalf of LPHA and on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Intercounty Association, which is known as MICA. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on the governor's budget today. As the local arm of the state's public health system, there are a number of items in this budget that impact us or that we have opinions about as they move forward. Because there are a number of things we're concerned about, I'm just going to give you a soundbite on each of the items today. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them either today or at any point in the future. First, I would like to briefly touch on the governor's proposal to reduce the statewide health improvement program. I know this is not in the purview of this committee, but you had such a rousing discussion about it yesterday that I can't help but weigh in a little bit. This is an important priority for our association. At the local level, we think it's an important piece of containing health care costs around the state, and while we do appreciate the governor maintains some level of funding for this program in his budget, we are concerned that at the level of funding he's recommending that you're not going to see the health care cost containment that was envisioned, nor the individual health improvements that was envisioned by the legislature last year. With the level of funding that is in the governor's budget currently, there would only be the ability to fund between 8 and 15 grants across the state to do these health improvement activities. That's a far cry from the legislature's vision last year of having a statewide program that would impact the health of all Minnesotans. And, you know, I would like to echo Representative Morgan's comments from yesterday that we feel strongly that this is an area of the budget where a reduction in this program will have long-term ripple effects on other parts of the state budget. And if we reduce our investment in this program today, we're going to continue to see the escalating health care costs in other parts of the state budget. But now on specifically to some items that are before you in the part of the budget that you all are concerned about, I'd like to talk about three of those items. And the first is the local public health block grant. You'll recall yesterday Mr. Acomb mentioned that the governor has a plan to change the way this block grant is paid to local communities. And I want to echo his comments yesterday that even with the quarter that's going to be shifted in funding, that we don't foresee any problems with this and our ability to manage that shift at the local level at this time. Frankly, we're pleased that the governor did not cut this program. The local public health block grant is, along with local property tax revenue, form the basis of the infrastructure of the local public health system, and it's critical to our ability to perform the wide range of things we do. And I did have two handouts. One of them that looks like this, that talks about the local public health system, does on the back have just a high-level overview of the list of types of things that your local health department does and that local public health block grant supports. So we appreciate the governor's decision to keep that program at full funding. Next, I'd like to talk about the proposed increase in funding for tuberculosis, which that line item in your budget would increase funding to support two FTE and some supplies in the state public health lab, and we do think that this is an important investment. The other handout that I provided for you, which is a broad overview of communicable disease in the state, has a little more specific discussion of tuberculosis as well as some other communicable diseases. But, you know, I assume you are probably all aware that TB is a disease that's increasing in Minnesota, and we do think that there's a need for additional investment here. That said, the local public health part of the system has a significant role related to TB control in our communities. We work hand-in-hand with the state health department on case investigation, and we're the folks on the ground who are there to provide the directly observed therapy on a daily basis. And so while we appreciate the governor's investment in the state health department, we also want to note that there are real needs at the local level. And particularly in the text box on this handout of examples from the field, you'll see the results of two recent outbreaks in St. Paul Ramsey and Nobles Rock, and how what might seem like a relatively small outbreak can really impact the bottom line of your local public health department. Third, I'd like to touch on the reductions in the Family Planning Special Project Grant proposed by the governor. We have concerns about this cut, not because we are necessarily the grant recipients for this fund. There are a couple of local health departments that receive funding through this program, but we are not the primary recipient of this funding. However, as Representative Huntley noted yesterday, Family Planning Services, we know that investing in upfront family planning services saves the state government budget money in other parts over on the MA side. And we have concerns that the 1115 waiver is not a perfect replacement for the FPSP block grant. That's somewhat how it's been characterized, that there's some federal funding that will cover the cuts in this program, and we know that that's not true. The 1115 waiver does not pay for the same things that the grant pays for. It pays for a subset of the activities, and it pays for only a subset of the population. And so we are concerned and want you to be aware that for the folks that receive FPSP grants, the 1115 waiver is not going to be a perfect solution for them.
Scott, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you.
I'm just curious. I'm a freshman, so you're going to have to clue me on what the 1115 waiver is and some of these things. It's a foreign language so far.
I'm looking at the list of testifiers because there will be folks who will talk more eloquently about this after I do. But Madam Chair and Representative, the 1115 waiver is a federal, essentially it's a source of MA funding. It's a waiver that we're getting from the federal government to provide some MA funding.
MA being?
Medical assistance. It is terrible. We do have a lot of acronyms. So it's medical assistance funding that would pay for some family planning medical services, some specific services in the family planning area.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is abortion included in that?
Madam Chair and Representative, no. Those are the three main things that I wanted to comment on today. You know, in closing, I'd just like to say we know that the state is facing an unprecedented budget deficit and that everyone has to be part of the solution. We are readily aware of that. I just urge you to consider the long-term impacts of cutting public health prevention programs that we know show dividends over time. They may not show budget savings in this biennium, but we know that they impact the health of people and the budget over time. And as you discussed yesterday in the committee, at least be aware of those things as you have to make the hard decisions. I look forward to working with you all throughout session and would be happy to answer any additional questions now or in the future.
Okay, Ms. Ring, any questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Do you want to take us through the overview?
Sure.
Next?
I think we'll do that and so we can get through it and then we'll come back to
here.
Oh, Pages, can you hand out the the documents, the overview documents. Remember, just to remind you, we're going to be adjourning here a little bit before 11:30, because at 11:30 we have the bipartisan, bicameral housing caucus that you're all invited to over at the State Capitol 118. There'll be pizza, and I need some brownies this morning, and I invite you all to come. So Emily's going to take us through the overview here.
Madam Chair and members, I apologize for being late. Sorry about that. but what you'll have in front of you, and I'll just go through this really quickly, it's just you've heard a lot of the testifiers and the agencies have given you some of this information, so just to kind of reiterate some of the things that you've heard. The first page, or you can go past that cover page, but it just lists out all of the different accounts that come under the jurisdiction of this committee. And so the Housing Finance Agency is one. We have all of the programs in that agency. The Department of Human Services, there are two activities, the Other Children and Economic Assistance Grant. There are a number of activities that fall in that. Last year, we had some funding that went in there for long-term homelessness services and food shelf programs, so those are the type of activities that go under that. And there is general fund money for that. And then the Refugee Services Grants is another program, but that's driven strictly by federal funding, so there's no general fund money that currently goes into that program. Under the Health Department, as you heard, we have the all of the programs except for the Policy and Quality Compliance. And some of the things that come under Community and Family Health Promotion, at the activity level, there are things like Health Promotion and Chronic Disease, the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, which used to stand on its own as a program, is now under that program heading, and then Community and Family Health, of course. Under Health Protection, there are activities such as Environmental Health, Infectious Disease, Prevention and Control, the Public Health Laboratory, and then the Office of Emergency Preparedness. And then Administrative Support Service is pretty straightforward. Before I talk about the rest of them, I just wanted to show you the spreadsheets. And not to get confusing, but since we have different agencies in this committee, we'll have two different spreadsheets. So if you look at the housing spreadsheet, that's the first one that I want to quickly go over. It's on the longer, the legal size piece of paper. And this one breaks out the housing activities. And so you'll see all those on the left. And then the columns so far, there's the November forecast, which is kind of like the base numbers. And then the columns next to that are the governor's recommendations. And then at the very end, it's the governor's recommendations, the difference between that and the base. So that's where you can kind of see if there are differences. And what I want to point out, under the first, it's the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program. In that area, there was some. There are three changes. The program consolidation area, that one was taking the urban Indian housing and the tribal Indian housing program and putting them underneath the challenge program. So it's not an increase in funding necessarily, because it's cost neutral. And then the reallocation to the housing trust fund, that was what Tanya Orr talked about, where they're taking $4 million per biennium out of the challenge program and allocating that to the housing trust fund. And then the 5% program decrease. And so that the 5% program decrease is really the biggest one, and that was the $4.496 million for the biennium. And I think that's all I wanted to point out on this. If you ever have questions about the spreadsheet or if it seems confusing, please feel free to ask me questions. And then the other spreadsheet, this is, if you've ever seen the Health and Human Services spreadsheets, they can be really long, really confusing. So this isn't the big spreadsheet. I just wanted to show you a couple of pages just to kind of get you used to it. I'm not done putting together the entire spreadsheet yet, so that'll take a, I should have it by next week. But so the way that you'll read this spreadsheet is if you look at the front page, these are just the changes that came with the governor's recommendation. And so if you look at on line 5, it says tuberculosis prevention and control. And under that, the way that the spreadsheet is laid out, it'll list it by funds. And so the only impact on this one is the general fund, and that's what the GF stands for on the left of there. And then you can see the total, so that it was an additional $200,000 in spending for each year. What I wanted to direct you to is on the second page on the back, if you look at line 10. I just kind of want to show you some of the different funds that might show up on these spreadsheets. That one says other for the drinking water contaminants and also for the source water protection. And that's that fund says other because that was that constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. So it's not, so the legislature has directive over how that will be spent, but it's not general fund spending per se. And then right underneath that, the next program is the well program fees. And that was, you heard the agency talk a little bit about that. And that fund is the SDSR fund, which is the State Government Special Revenue Fund. So when there are changes to that, you'll see one line that is a fee revenue line. So it's a negative number because it's adding money to the SDSR. But again, that what they like to do with the fees is that they kind of try to become revenue neutral as well. I think that's all I wanted to point out about that. And again, these spreadsheets can be really complicated, so ask lots of questions. And let's see, the only other thing I wanted to go over, if you go back to the division accounts, we don't always talk a lot about these accounts, but under the committee we have all of the health-related boards, and those are all listed right there. And those are primarily funded through the State Government Special Revenue Fund. And then the Disability Council, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and the Ombudsperson for Families. And those three programs are general funds. And these will all show up in the Health and Human Services spreadsheet. So once I get that completed, I'll pass that around and you can see that.
Thank you so much, Sadie. Any questions
you have right now?
Well, I just want to reiterate that Sadie is a really good resource. If you have any questions, and your office is on the
third
floor.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll get a lot more familiar with these as we go along. So let's go back to our public testimony. Next, Peg LeBoer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Speak a little bit about the budget cuts and the way that family planning in Minnesota.
You want to move the microphone a little more towards you. There you go.
For some of you, this is going to be kind of a refresher course, and for others, it might be new information. But there are basically two pots of money that fund family planning services in Minnesota. One is a total state-funded grant program called Family Planning Special Project Grants. And the other is the federal waiver program, which is called Minnesota Family Planning Program. For the grant program that is state money, it serves and gives grants to 42 programs serving a large number of cities in the state. Most of the programs that get this money are nonprofit programs. There are some public health departments that also get it, and there are some sub-grantees of larger organizations. But most of it is standalone family planning clinics run in their neighborhoods by people serving on boards who are from the community. I was the director of Family Tree Clinic for 26 years until I retired at the end of 2007. So I have a bit of experience in running clinics with very little money. The thing you need to understand about the grant program is that it is a competitive program. And last time around, when the grants were awarded, there were $13 million in grants requested and a little over $10 million granted. So if you weren't in the top rated groups, you got no money. It didn't mean your program was invaluable. It didn't mean you didn't serve a needy population. It simply meant the money ran out. So now we're faced with an issue of taking a look at this system across the state and having a budget cut that's almost 20%. That will, I will guarantee you, eliminate some significant programs, particularly in greater Minnesota, who have fewer resources to begin with. The rationale delivered by the governor on this cut says, basically, that with the federal family planning program, it is going to take over those groups. Well, let me tell you a little bit about delivery systems. In Minnesota, 25 of the clinics provide the delivery system for the federal program. So if you eliminate them or portions of them, you will have no delivery system for funding, for getting the federal program to anybody. The other issue with the federal program is that it's a difficult application. It does not apply to everybody who needs and who would seek subsidized services. and it requires kind of a sophisticated level of being able to keep track of income and other things. You have to submit a number of proofs for this program. So you can sign up, you can get 3 months worth of service, but if you haven't provided your proof, or if the Department of Human Services has not finished your paperwork within that 3 months, you are now out of the program. You're back to having no options or needing to go to the program where you can get a sliding fee scale effort at a community clinic. So it is not, this, the federal program was never intended when the legislation was done and when the state applied. It was not intended to take over the state's grant program. It was to supplement and expand. So I'm not exactly sure where the governor got that rationale, but it really didn't apply in what the application from the department went to the federal government. The 42 grantees that are getting state money that will get the 20% cut serve 27,000 people. That's a lot of people for 42 programs. And they provide a variety of things besides birth control supplies. Remember, the population that basically comes to these kinds of clinics is between the ages of usually 18 and 30. They don't have insurance. They're not under their parents' insurance anymore. They are in jobs that traditionally don't actually offer them insurance until they've worked for a significant longer period of time. Think of Target. You know, think of the fast food restaurants. Think of the places that don't cover people. This is the population that tends to come to family planning clinics. So they don't have a lot of disposable income in their pocket to pay for health care. So most of these programs run, or actually all of the grant programs run on a sliding fee scale. So people pay whatever their income indicates they can afford to pay. The clinic must then come up with the difference between what the patient pays and what it actually costs. The family planning grants basically underwrite some of the basic costs so that a clinic can stay open, they can have phones, they can pay their rent, you know, they can underwrite some of the salary of the medical personnel. Then the patient pays a portion, and then the clinic has to go out and fundraise the rest. And believe me, in this environment, that is an incredibly difficult task these days. As a clinic director for 27 years, I ended in the last 5 years spending most of my time raising money. The other thing that's interesting about the federal waiver program, it pays less than 50% of the cost of a clinic visit. If you average out for a year, it costs about $185. It pays less than 50%. So even with the federal program, you still got to go out and fundraise.
Just a little bit more time.
Yeah, just one thing. We always talk about $1 you spend in family planning is going to save $4.40, which is what the sort of national calculations are for birth and delivery, not for long-term care, just birth and delivery. If you reverse that, for every decrease in family planning funds that you're going to have, an additional $5.40 of public expenses for prenatal and delivery costs. So it is likely that the governor's proposed cuts to family planning of $1,050,000 each year will result in an additional expense to the state of $5,670,000 a year, or $11,340,000 for the biennium. I don't think that's the direction that you need to go if you're short of money to add costs to your already burdened situation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. LeBlanc? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Do what, Ms. Phillips? Just want to remind everybody we have three, 4 minutes for business. We want to give you a chance for some questions and I want to try to hear everybody today. If we don't, we'll have to try to bring you back another time. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Sue Watlow. So if they do have handouts for the committee. I do have a few extra for folks in the audience. Again, my name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing. I've been working with people experiencing homelessness or in a housing crisis for 35 years. Elam serves over 6,000 people, primarily in the metro area. Many of the communities represented here. We service folks that are at risk or experiencing homelessness through prevention, screening, rapid exit or rapid rehousing, transitional housing, rent subsidies, permanent supportive housing, and information and referral. So many of the items that were listed on your spreadsheet are ways that ELIM is funded. We receive about $2.5 million is our budget, and about $2 million is government funds, about $1.5 million is state funding, and about $500,000 is federal funding. I'm also the president and owner of Integrated Community Solutions, which is a for-profit consulting company working with communities and individuals to create stable, healthy communities utilizing and integrating resources together. Also a board member of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, the National Coalition for the Homeless, and MICA, which is the Metro Interstate Council on Affordable Housing. The packet that you have, I basically want to talk about three ways that you can increase resources for this committee, and also to utilize resources in a more effective way. As I make my comments, let me be clear that I'm talking for ELIM Transitional Housing and Integrated Community Solutions, and some of these recommendations are and may be supported by the other groups I also represent, but I'm specifically speaking for the first two organizations. The first one is regards to the budget. Today you're looking at the governor's appropriation budget for this committee. Obviously, I strongly encourage you as you move through this session to look at the tax expenditure budget. So if you go past that first green page, which is the money page, and look at the second page, you will see that for those of us that are homeowners, we are able to write off $156 million in 2008 on property taxes and $400.9 million in home interest deduction, and that grows and has tails as we move into this next biennium. Now, we could save and bring into revenue between $200 and $300 million if we would basically do the base funding, as we talked about in appropriations. If we would maintain the same amount that we either did in 2008, it'd be about $300 million. We did the same amount that we did in 2009 and do those same numbers for 2010 and 2011 by basically capping what we're allowing people to write off on their personal income tax, we would generate revenue of between $200 and $300 million. That could then be used for many of the housing cuts that we are talking about here today, like the youth program that will lose its $1 million in for one-time money, as well as transitional housing and other programs that receive one-time money. The second piece, if you go past that page then, were two bills that came before this committee that we asked to be tabled to have some further discussion with agencies, state agencies, about whether we could do this without going forward with state law. One is called the Interagency Coordination on Homelessness. And this is really to take that spreadsheet that you have in front of you, and those programs are in those different departments because it really meets the needs of the folks within in those departments. They have the services and the different resources to help folks with the housing crisis. But the thing is, we don't coordinate. And so many of us programs, both in urban areas as well as in greater Minnesota, use multiple funding sources from the state. But we can't move people between different programs because of the rules within the particular program. So what we're suggesting is not a block grant. We're saying keep it still in the pot that it is. But let's make sure that the rules within the different programs work so that if it's more cost-effective to have somebody in a long-term homeless housing trust fund rent subsidy and not in transitional housing or not in a group residential housing long-term homeless program, then we are able to move people to a more cost-effective program. And if people need more services, to get them into more appropriate services. We also would like to make sure that our programs are helping people be able to be stable in the community and move on to be able to access federal resources like Section 8 housing. So we want to make sure that we as a program have the ability to ask people to pay rent, to be good tenants, and to not destroy property, and that they would actually apply for subsidized housing and other resources in the community. We have some programs that don't allow us to do that. We can't require people to do that. So we're asking that we take a look at a way that we can make sure that across all of our programs that we are creating incentives for people to move along in this program. We are hopeful that we will reintroduce this bill again. That packet talks a little bit about the language that we had last year that was introduced in this committee and some information as Senator Marty took a look at this bill last year in the Senate. The final piece, and I will conclude with this, is on the Homeless Management Information System. The acronym is HMIS, for those of you that are new to this committee. Not to be confused with, although may really have some actual merit in calling it, Hazardous Material Identification System. Which is, if you Google this, that's what you'll get, those two. And there's actually four out of the top six. Four of the top six is Hazardous Material Identification System. Well, HMIS has become that to a large degree here in Minnesota. We spend as much on collecting data about people experiencing homelessness as we do in the state and state appropriations for shelter every year. Okay, let me say that again. What we spend collecting data on people experiencing homelessness is as much as we are spending in state appropriations on emergency shelter. And that's a lot of questions that we're asking, data that we're not using. Now, HUD requires that we provide them data on who's actually in shelters and in transitional housing and on outreach. But we're collecting data on family homeless prevention, on long-term homeless housing trust fund, and on other programs. And we don't have to collect that data. And we can still get the federal money. So that costs ELIM $50,000 a year to collect that data because we have to collect it in the system. Plus, we maintain a backup system, which costs us only about $10,000. So we spend about $60,000 on data collection. $50,000 we think we could just throw away, which is primarily private, primarily individual donations that are coming to our organization that we basically have to do because it's not required by equal in state legislation. But state agencies require us, if we want to get state dollars, to participate in this. So I encourage you to take a look at that. Again, we are looking at reintroducing this. And the thing with HUD, they put out an annual report about the HMIS data. They say now into its eighth year, it's a work in progress, and that it really even shouldn't be used for planning. And so we're collecting data that the federal government says should need to be used, and we're using that for planning. Finally, I think that you're going to hear from a lot of programs. We all do very good work. We all have very good statistics. And are helping a lot of folks stabilize in housing, prevent people from becoming homeless. I encourage, as we move through a very difficult legislative session, that you don't ask us to compete against each other for those dollars. We need outreach. We need shelter. We need transitional housing. We need prevention. We need rent subsidies. We need long-term homeless services. We need, you know, subsidies. We need permanent supportive housing. Please do not have us fighting against each other as we're looking at those dollars. Find ways that we can work together in making sure that we have the resources to address all those needs. And you're going to hear different stats. Well, if you do this program, you will save this much money. Well, the thing we need to do is look at, okay, we'll save this much money on the front end. How much money do we spend with tails in the long run, too? So I just encourage you to look at the entire picture. In conclusion, homelessness is a life and death issue. We had over 115 people that we remembered at a memorial service this last December that died this last year. Some that were actually still homeless, some that had been homeless, that had gotten back into housing. I just encourage you that we remember, many of us as people of faith, that we are called to treat others as we'd want to be treated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lala Phillips. I think there's one question, and then Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me for being late this morning. Ms. Lala Phillips, how are you today?
I'm doing well.
Good, good. I just had a quick question on HMIS. I kind of am a little familiar with that system. Is it just the data collection that's costing you so much, or is it the actual system and its inefficiencies that cost so much money to work with?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, it's both. It takes about 5% of my staff time to just collect the paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking, you know, 2 hours or more a week on just frontline staff people, just to collect the paperwork. Mm-hmm. And then we have to enter the data. That costs us about $20,000 to $25,000 a year. And then there's hardware costs and things like that. So we're collecting on some in different programs, and each program has different questions that we answer. So in some programs we're collecting 120 data elements on folks that are going through that program. HUD only requires us to collect 14.
Mm-hmm.
So what we would like is to stay with 14 and then stay with whatever the state is requiring us to collect as far as data, which there's very minimal data that you actually ask us to collect, so maybe an additional 5 questions. So we think that we can collect all the data that they want, as well as what the state's requiring, probably about 20 questions.
Okay.
Thank you so much. We're going to kind of move along. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have with us the 9th through 12th graders from St. Francis Christian School. Welcome to the committee. If you want to stand up, we'll welcome you. So you're from St. Francis, Minnesota, is that right? Okay, great, welcome. All right, Michael Dahl. And members and public members, we have to leave right at 11:30, and we got three people that we want to hear from today. We might have to schedule more of you, you know, another time. We will schedule you. We want to hear from everybody, but it probably won't be too much more today. It won't be more today than what we have on the schedule. So, Michael, got about 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Public Policy Director with HomeLine. HomeLine is an organization that provides direct legal advice to low-income tenants as they're struggling to maintain their housing. And each year we take about 11,000 calls from people who have a variety of problems. The number one issue for all of them is, the number one issue for them is affordability. Can they afford to live where they are? And if not, how do they find a new place to live? Now, in the governor's budget, first of all, I want to say that our state housing finance agency is nationally recognized, one of the best. What the housing finance agency does, it does very well. You heard earlier this week or last week that the state appropriations account for a very small portion of what the housing finance agency manages. It's the state appropriation that actually allows us to buy down the cost of housing to get to really low-income people. So a decision about how much you're going to put into the state housing, the housing finance agency with state dollars is really a question of how low of an income can we reach and how many people will we reach, because the federal dollars really are gauged at 30 and 50% of area median income, 80% of median income, which really isn't reaching many of those that we're talking about that we want to help. It's really bad out there, and it's gotten worse. And I just want to ask this, and Sue actually made a comment about this, that there's a lot of information out there. Try not to get too infatuated with the data, because guess what? We've had the data with us for a very long period of time. We've all been really concerned that the problem's bad and it's getting worse, and then we do relatively little to actually address that problem. I want to give to you a spreadsheet that I prepared this morning, and it has MHFA state appropriation adjusted for inflation, comparing for when the first biennium that I sort of saw that this was getting to be a bad problem. And it was in 2000-2001. There was a legislative auditor's report that said that in the 1990s, that renters' income had only raised by 9%, but rents had raised by 34%. Well, we got to do something. And so we actually that year appropriated about $166 million to the State Housing Finance Agency. Have that applied with inflation, today's dollars, that's about $209 million. The governor is proposing that we appropriate $85 million, far less than half of what we did when we first said this is a problem, it's getting worse. 2 years later, we released a report from BBC Research that the Housing Finance Agency put out, and the big statistic there was that if state funding was just the same level and federal funding was the same level and private funding was the same level, in the next decade, we would have an additional 33,000 households, low-income households, where there wouldn't be a place for them to live. We would not have an affordable place for them to live. Well, we got to do something about that. Well, we took a step back that year. We've had data upon data just telling us that the situation is terrible, and we gotta get ahead of it. Now, when I pointed out that the Housing Finance Agency does a great job, one thing they don't do a lot of is long-term rental assistance to people who, for a very long period of time, can't pay their rent. The jobs don't pay enough for them to pay their rent. We provide short-term assistance to help people through crisis. We provide long-term assistance if you're long-term homeless, so homeless for a year or more. And we do things to help landlords, you know, entice them into providing low-income housing, and we build housing. But we do very, very little for the long-term affordability needs of low-income renters. Now, there are 20, right now there's about over 100,000 households in Minnesota that are paying more than 50% of their income for housing. And there is no state response to help them. the federal testimony you heard on federal subsidies, well, that's basically to build places. It's not to help people pay their rent. And the state budget, as I said, most of that money is for short-term crisis. It's not help to help people pay their rent. And it's getting worse. What you can do to help people pay their rent in this very difficult time is have more rental assistance to low-income people so they can afford to live where they're living right now. If we don't, they're the ones that are going to make choices between whether or not they eat today or not, how high they turn their electricity up. What are they going to do? What will they cut so they can continue to afford where they live? Thank you. So one other thing.
Okay.
I wasn't going to pass this off because this is darn ridiculous. You're not going to be able to see this too well, but there's two bar graphs here. One you can't see at all, and the other you can. The gray line here says how much money the state has in its budget designated for everything other than housing. It's like 99.something%. And if the advocates had our way, it would still be 99.something%. We would switch from 0.27% of the state's budget for housing to 0.67%. You can't see what it is the advocates are asking for as a change. It doesn't show on the radar. When this committee thinks about the power it has to affect what is one of the biggest problems for our economy right now, you ain't got nothing. And the governor wants to cut it. Thank you.
Mr. Dahl, any questions? Thank you very much.
Mike Davis.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Mike Davey. I'm a community organizer and policy advocate and attorney with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Like a lot of folks that have talked today, and I'm sure all of you, I've had a chance to think about how the proposed budget is going to affect people. And in particular, I've had a chance to think about how it's going to affect people experiencing homelessness, not unlike the folks that Patrick and I talked about last week. And, you know, I want to put what I'm going to talk about today in a little bit of perspective. You know, when I talk to people like Ted or Kathleen, Shelley or Jesse, many of the homeless people with whom I have the privilege of organizing, I'm quickly reminded that the resources this committee decided to invest to address homelessness during the 2008-2009 biennium made a real difference in thousands of people's lives. And it's true that some of those resources were non-base appropriations. But for the agencies, and certainly for the homeless families, children, runaway or unaccompanied youth, or individuals that camp outside because they have no place to go, or the individuals that are staying in shelter waiting for help, they certainly really don't see this distinction as mattering much. What they do know is that those additional resources invested meant that more people in need could get help. And so with this viewpoint in mind, the proposed budget that many of you have already had a chance to look at and that I've had a chance to look at, what it would invest to address homelessness looks drastically different than the resources invested during the 2008-2009 biennium. For example, during the 2008-2009 biennium, 32 agencies applied for a portion of the $1 million in non-based funding made available as part of the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. Only 19 of those 32 agencies received funding. On page 337 of the agency-level narrative for the Human Services Department, funding for the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act is cut by 100%, from $1 million to zero. And I'm not sure what these 19 agencies that were lucky to receive funding, or the 32 agencies that need funding, are going to do. Thankfully, there's some folks that will be here to testify next to talk a little bit more about this incredibly important resource. The legislature's decision to invest $6.7 million in the Transitional Housing Grants Program in the last biennium meant that during the biennium, about 8,000 families and individuals will have gained access to housing and supportive services, allowing them to ultimately secure permanent, stable housing. 750,000 of that was non-based funding. And again, on page 337 of the agency-level narrative for Human Services, 2010-2011 funding for the Transitional Housing Grants Program is 12% less when compared to the 2008-2009 biennium. Does this mean that 960 fewer families and individuals will be served? I don't know. I do know that we should be investing more in this very successful and sought-after program, not less. And this is actually why we propose increasing biennial appropriations for this program to just under $16 million. We definitely need to be not decreasing resources for this incredibly important program. We should be increasing them. During the 08-09 biennium, the legislature invested about $1.3 million in the emergency services program. These resources funded the operating costs of shelter, street outreach, and essential services to homeless families and individuals. And according to the governor, over 3,000 individuals are served by this program each year. Again, 600,000 of this was non-based funding. And again, for the 2010-2011 funding cycle for the emergency services program, if it's implemented as proposed, it would be 54% less when compared to the 08-09 biennium. More people than ever are seeking out shelter. We believe that we should invest more to shelter people, not less. And this is why we propose increasing biennial appropriations for emergency services to $8.3 million. And I should say that the $16 million for the transitional housing program and the $8.3 million here are based on what shelters in the state and transitional housing programs in the state requested in assistance during the last biennium. And then lastly, during the 08-09 biennium, the legislature invested $12 million in long-term homeless services grants. The proposed budget recommends investing about $10 million in long-term homeless service grants. And according to the Corporation for Supportive Housing, a $42 million investment is needed actually to meet the needs of people who are in permanent supportive housing or who are living in existing permanent supportive housing or would be living in units that are currently under construction or in some form of development. And I know time is short, so with that I'll conclude and answer any questions that folks might have.
Okay. Any questions from committee members? There's one number that I think is always helpful for us when we're talking about the cost of housing people who are homeless either, and it's a comparison, and I'm wondering if you can help us out today, the difference between putting a person in a shelter, what it costs to just say for a family of two or three or four, versus putting them into some sort of other opportunity for housing, some personal housing or some other
Madam Chair, members of the committee. And there's other folks here that might have a more accurate number, but I believe it costs. Actually, why don't I have Sue Wallace come up here and?
Okay. We just
have a brief.
Yeah. Just briefly,
Madam Chair, Sue Wallace Phillips. For a shelter, it depends on what community in the metro area we're looking at. For a family of four, typically around $3,000 to $4,000 per month. We can do prevention for that same family by keeping them in their housing through the family homeless prevention, typically for an average of under $750. And we can provide transitional housing typically for that family at less than $10 a day. Then depending upon what other types of housing you're looking at, there's different costs.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think it's really helpful for the committee to have those numbers because when we start thinking about these issues, and Representative Huntley isn't here, but we're going between different silos of budgets, but it's a dramatic difference. So thank you for that information. Okay, our last person today, Dr. Heather Houston. Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'd also like to introduce Kristen Freebridge from Losing Social Services, who's with me today.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and committee members, you know my name is Heather Hughesby, and I serve as the Executive Director of YouthLink in Minneapolis. YouthLink is one of the oldest agencies among many agencies, but one of the oldest agencies that serves particularly homeless young people. YouthLink is the place where the end of homelessness and the end of poverty begin for youth. And I'm pleased to be here. We were one of the 19 agencies that received last year the non-based appropriations for the Runaway Homeless Youth Act, and I'm here to talk about that today. And I guess I'm here to really talk about the grassroots, about I just left YouthLink and see youth that are in that center, and every night we have over 55 young people who are homeless who are trying to get a hot meal, and I'm here representing them. There's more than, as you know, as some most of you know, more than 22,000 homeless young people in Minneapolis or in Minnesota in a year. On any given night, we have between 600 and 650 unaccompanied homeless young people in the state of Minnesota. There are our young people that are homeless are often a hidden population. They're often, if you come into our drop-in center or any of the other agencies, they would look like maybe any other teenager or any young person that you might see. I've always said when I came into this that I'd walk out in the drop-in and it would look like, I'd like to see young people that look like my daughter. They're also hidden because they're often trading different things to live in someone's house. It can be trading sex. It can be trading as they are in the drop-in center, coming and looking for a loaf of bread, some milk, so that they can stay at someone's house. Last year, the legislators, some of them have toured YouthLink and had an opportunity to actually talk to our youth, and they will tell you exactly, boldly, what their life is like. Fortunately, YouthLink and others among the 19 agencies were able to receive some funding from the non-based appropriations for Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. We received $65,000 to use with our crisis drop-in center. And that's often the first stop that those young people in the Twin Cities will visit, where they can get stabilized, they can get a hot meal, and they can get services. Well, let me just talk just briefly about some of the things that have happened. More than 1,465 unduplicated young people last year accessed the doors of the drop-in center. In our street outreach, we reached over 3,000 young people in the Twin Cities. More than 150 of those young people we engaged in education. 73% we were able to find some type of housing that they can stay in for more than 3 months. 60% of those young people we got into the appropriate mental health services to get them their mental health diagnosed. 37 young people received their GED, and 80% of those are now enrolled in post-secondary education. But still, the need isn't met. Every night in our drop-in center, and last night was one, it'll be another night tonight, we're turning away at least 20 of those young people that have no safe place to go. In the shelter system in Minneapolis, we have 65 shelter beds that are particularly tailored for young people. Last year, for every young person that that got a shelter bed, two were turned away. There were over 3,500 young people who were turned away from shelter beds, and that was a duplicated because they may go to the same shelters. So what's happening to those young people tonight, last night, when they didn't have any place to stay? Well, as some of you heard in the drop-in center, yes, last year, we've had to give some young people bus passes to stay on the bus. Some are staying in abandoned buildings. I have pictures from our drop-in staff and from our outreach workers of places that they have camped out under bridges. And we know as a fact that those young people who are on the streets more than 30 days are entering into prostitution very quickly. In the past 6 months, the Minneapolis schools have seen a 19% increase in the number of young people who are identified as homeless. We recently had a report that in the St. Paul schools, there's been a 17% increase in the last 6 months of those young people that are homeless. In our drop-in center, we're seeing a 20% increase each month of young people who are coming in who have no place to go. 72% of our agencies, of the 18 agencies in a recent report in the Twin Cities that are working with the homeless, have had to turn people away because of our capacity. I think, as Mike said and others, that you have to see the face of homelessness to really sometimes understand. And I see those faces every single day. It's like Jeremy, who came to the drop-in center who simply wanted some basic needs met to get a name on a birth certificate so he wasn't referred to on his birth certificate as baby boy. It's Marissa, who's been on the streets and been sexually abused, who's 16, 17 years old, who we finally got into the drop-in center and we were able to diagnose some of the mental health issues that she's had and some of the traumatic brain injuries. But I think probably the most profound thing that I've seen recently is a picture that we're hanging up in our drop-in center. We have an art program called Culture Club at YouthLink that helps those young people to express themselves through exposure to the arts. Amanda drew a self-portrait that we have hung up of herself and sitting on the corner with the traditional cup in her hand. And it's a very profound picture. You can see hope in her eye, but you can see the trauma in her face. And she wrote on the side of that picture, she said, "I don't need coins, I need change." There's one common theme with our youth. There is a desire for stability. They do want change. And so I'm really here today to ask to please, I think that the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, to at least to try to get that back into the funding priorities, because I think that is about change. By putting that back into the funding priority, the bill, back into that, that we're helping to uncover what's often a hidden issue, the reality of homelessness, to bring that into the light for these young people so that we can make a difference, so that they don't end up to be long-term homeless, so that they can become contributing members of our community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hussey. We're really out of time. Do you have a short comment to make?
Very short. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson Stembridge. I work with the Prison Social Service of Minnesota. I just wanted to make one comment about the importance of this funding for Greater Minnesota. As you can see in your spreadsheets, of the 19 organizations that received funding from the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, 9 of those are from Greater Minnesota. It's very challenging to secure funds, especially in Greater Minnesota. And we know that the closer we can serve youth to their communities of origin, the more effective we're going to be in providing them the stability that they need to be self-sufficient members of our communities whenever they are able to find their path towards that end. And I also wanted to reaffirm what Ben said earlier, that it's a difficult time and we all need to do belt tightening, and we're certainly doing our share at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota at this moment. We provide 26 lines of services across the state of Minnesota, have services in every county, and one of our primary priorities relates to homeless youth because of all those lines of services, all very challenging to meet the needs for. Providing funding for homeless youth services is the most challenging. And so, members, this is why this is a very important priority. We thank you for the leadership you've already shown and ask you to continue that. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your leadership and service. I'm sorry we're short of time today, but, you know, we are going to have some opportunity for more testimony next week and invite you back and others. So, committee, we are having... Okay, who would like to... Representative Scott, would you like to move the minutes for the day?
Yeah, I
move
the minutes.
Do you approve?
February
3rd. Okay. Do you approve? Okay. I'll see the minutes. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Committee, we are adjourned. And.